Coming up on Life is a Festival.
I did not have one of those transformational experiences that everybody's talking about where you first go to Burning Man and, oh my God, my life is so different now. I went to Burning Man and went, oh, yeah, I like that. That's neat. Kind of a rough desert you got here, but that's pretty amazing. But I actually think it's really, really important that we don't make the idea that someone has done Burning Man contingent on whether or not they've had a transformational experience, which I think is implicit in the language of transformational experience that is so often attached to Burning Man. Oh, well, if your consciousness wasn't raised and raised by at least 30%, then clearly you're underperforming. No, 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 no. That's such bullshit. It's kind of amazing when you think about it that an event whose early iterations included fast cars and drive-by shooting ranges is now the single most significant new age transformational pilgrimage site in the world. I mean, how did that happen?
Hello, my friends and fellow travelers. It is about that time for those of us who head out to the fantastic pilgrimage of Burning Man to procrastinate as much as we can and do all of our packing at the last minute. So for me, in order to procrastinate vigorously, I have decided to dedicate some time to repurposing an old podcast, my favorite podcast I've done about Burning Man, and offer it to you for your drive out to the playa. This is the Burning Man philosophy episode. And I recorded it 4 years ago with Caveat Magister, who is the philosopher laureate of the Burning Man Project. And he had just published his book, The Definitive Look at Burning Man Philosophy, The Scene That Became Cities, which is what we talk about on the show. This particular episode, I think, is so helpful if you are going to Burning Man for the first time or if you've been many times, because it gets into the intricacies of how we experience Burning Man philosophically, but we experience Burning Man philosophically by doing. It's a bit of a paradox. Turns out a lot of Burning Man is a paradox, and living in the paradox, in the tension between principles, in the unexpected contrast, that's actually where transformation occurs. If you want it to occur, turns out you don't have to do that either, and that's actually super important. Anyway, on the show, we talk about what it means to burn. We talk about giving gifts and building communities. We talk about transformation and how Burning Man does not have to be transformational. We talk about how it's okay to be miserable at Burning Man. We talk about a brief history of who ruined Burning Man. We get into the question, is Burning Man a white people thing? And we end with the 10 principles as skills and also their shadow opposites. So Caveat Magister is the philosopher laureate of the Burning Man Project. Before that, he lived in a Buddhist monastery in India, covered international nightlife for Playboy.com, earned a master's degree in interdisciplinary linguistics, taught autobiographical writing to high school-age students in prison, and was a founding member of Burning Man's Philosophical Center. Caveat is the author of 5 books, including The Scene That Became Cities, and most recently, Turn Your Life Into Art, Lessons in Psychomagic from San Francisco's Underground, which is a how-to manual for creating transformative experiences. Links to his work can be found at fascinatingstranger.com. But before I bring you Caveat Magister, I have a treat for you. Well, I imagine it's a treat for you. If you've been listening to this show, you might be interested in my particular philosophies and my particular way of looking at things. And I've mentioned it briefly on the show, but I've been writing a book. It covers all the things I talk about on the show, and I'm very excited. I've been diligently, well, sometimes not so diligently, but mostly diligently working on this project. I thought that as a way of prepping you for Burning Man and as a way of moving forward my particular dedication to this writing, I would read you a piece on the chapter that I have written about Burning Man. And by the way, if you want to skip this and just hear from Caveat, I don't mind. I'm not even going to know. So do what you want. And have an amazing burn. How do you write about Burning Man and not make it sound like another California cult? One of the founders, Ranger Danger, says that it is in fact a cult. It's just that you wash your brain yourself. The people who go to Burning Man and make it part of their year-round identity are called burners. And trust me, we can be just as insufferable as any other cult member. So if I wanted to impress upon you the particular magic of this place, I could wax poetic about the awe I felt on my very first night, how it was like being dropped into the middle of an electric space carnival. But I feel like that would be like trying to describe what it feels like to blast off on an acid trip. Language like otherworldly and mind-bending are equal parts insufficient and hyperbolic. If I just called the experience ineffable, that would be far worse, because if it's indescribable, who's the idiot trying to describe it? And I don't want to try too hard either and start sounding like a pushy evangelist. As impactful as it has been for so many, Burning Man is a silly place. It loses its power when we take it too seriously. So if you haven't gone, can't go, or don't want to go, I still believe it's worth your time to attempt to understand the experience. I adore David Bowie because his unending iterations meant that his fans all fell in love with their own version of him. I first experienced Bowie as the Goblin King in the 1986 film The Labyrinth, and that's the Bowie I will always love the most. He was so cool and extravagant, and he loved Jennifer Connelly with poetic desperation. I was too young to decide whether I wanted to be him or be loved by him like that, but I will say his codpiece did fascinate me. Burning Man is like Bowie in this way. Everyone has their own special idea of what the place is, which is part of why they get so up in arms about who they think is ruining it. My favorite line comes from my friend Juice, who calls it contrived hardship to expedite bonding. We go into an inhospitable environment, and we have the audacity to organize groups of emotionally under-resourced amateurs to erect large-scale art projects. The inevitable fiascos are like enzymes that accelerate the chemical reactions of our transformation. There is a strange magic that bubbles up from the emotional stew of our collective meltdowns and how we help each other back up. It seems to me that all real communities grow out of a shared confrontation with survival. Larry Harvey, Burning Man's iconic co-founder, once said, "Communities are not produced by sentiment or mere goodwill. They grow out of a shared struggle. Our situation in the desert is an incubator for community. Communal effort is one of Burning Man's principles. In order to survive in the desert, it is natural to form camps and collaborate on large projects. We are, after all, social beings. My community was called Elephant Bird." My very first year, I plunged headfirst into leading a small camp with my friend Graham. I really had no idea what to expect. Our first mistake upon arriving in the desert was attempting to build a massive stage out of wood in the scorching Nevada heat. It was hell to assemble the clunky 2x4s and a disc-slipping disaster to lug our construction back home. I suppose we could have just burned it. Burning things is pretty popular at Burning Man. And apparently, ash isn't considered trash. Burners are very sensitive about trash, or matter out of place, moop, as we call it. Considering the sawdust, our build site was a moop nightmare, and it took a long time to tidy up. The preoccupation with moop comes from another principle, leave no trace, which emerged from the wilderness preservation movement of the mid-20th century. On all land managed by the U.S. government and open to the public, visitors are encouraged to pack it in, pack it out, to minimize impact. For Burning Man, which is leased from the Bureau of Land Management, this is gospel. Not only is it the right thing to do, but otherwise the vast menagerie of crusty hippies would not be invited back. You can deposit what you wish in a dumpster in Reno, but you better leave the Black Rock Desert itself pristine. Not all fun is created equal. Apparently, there's a scale for fun, which also came out of outdoor culture. Type 1 fun is obviously enjoyable, and things generally go according to plan, like a night out dancing with your friends. Type 2 fun is unpleasant at the time, but you remember it as a hoot, like that time you got lost on a hike and barely made it out before coyotes got you, but your group all got a bit closer and now have a great story to tell. Whether holding down infrastructure in a gnarly dust storm or holding quivering friends with faces stained by dusty tears, Burning Man involves a lot of Type 2 fun. Some say there is such a thing as Type 3 fun, which isn't actually fun at all. Burning Man is also Type 3 fun sometimes. There's a popular expression, which originated in the early days of Burning Man by the Department of Public Works, the close-knit team that builds the city's infrastructure each year. Safety third. This c'est la vie attitude towards danger has since become part of the wider culture. Consider Disneyland, where safety comes first and experience is choreographed and sanitized. How do you expect to be transformed from behind a piece of plexiglass? In indigenous rites of passage, the fear of, even the distinct possibility of death, is a key ingredient in the process of metamorphosis. Your Burning Man ticket says that you, dear ticket holder, may be subject to death, and absolves the organization of any responsibility. Death is listed 5 times in Burning Man's terms and conditions, i.e. the thing no one reads. However, statistically, Black Rock City is actually safer in many respects than other cities of its size. Memento mori, remember that you must die. This is a strategy for living in the present moment. From Buddhist death meditation to Heidegger's being towards death, our proximity to our demise gives us life. Simply being a bit jacked up by danger can be type 2 fun. It invigorates us. The practice of trading safety for a more authentic experience supports immediacy, which the Burning Man organization considers the most important touchstone of value in its culture. Immediacy means to surrender to the experience directly in front of you. There is a passivity in our daily lives that makes it easy to stay in the same behavior patterns. Guy Debord calls this the society of the spectacle. We are passive consumers of experience. If you wish to be more than a passive spectator of your life, you must become an active participant, which brings us to the principle of participation. Attendees say Burning Man is a duocracy, meaning that you lead by doing. You don't actually have to be good at anything to participate. That's the point. You just have to get up on the stage and give it a try. In my second year at Burning Man, my band, I Can Dress Myself, and another band came together in an attempt to play the Beatles album, The Magical Mystery Tour, in its entirety. We were woefully ill-prepared, and at any given time, about half of the musicians on stage had no idea what we were doing. I blew out my voice screaming, "I am the walrus." Strings broke, lights broke, really everything broke. The fine alkaline powder that makes up the playa is not kind to electronic equipment. The fiasco came to a crescendo on the last song when our generator failed and there was a complete blackout of our stage and our camp. However, in the ensuing darkness, the entire audience continued singing "All You Need Is Love" together, a cappella, arm in arm. Things go like that out there. Sometimes a complete disaster can turn on a dime to become your favorite memory and one hell of a bonding experience. Okay, so that's a little passage from my book. It's not done yet. I'll probably change it a lot, but I wanted to share it with you, my fellow travelers. And if you like it, or if you have any feedback or whatever, you can message me on Instagram. I'm at Eamon Armstrong. So that was a long and perhaps self-indulgent preamble. But now here is Burning Man's philosopher laureate, Caveat Magister. Welcome to my home.
Thank you.
Hi. Thanks for being inside on a sunny day.
It's gorgeous, but this is good too.
We were just joking just before we started recording that you've had some interviews where the first question is, so what is Burning Man?
Yeah, that was a short form television interview. There was 6 minutes and the host, who was lovely and quite good at this, but had no idea what we were going to be talking about. So what is Burning Man?
What would be a home run interview for you, considering that most of the audience are going to be familiar with Burning Man. Mm. Some of them are longtime burners who have a deep feeling about what this is.
Yeah.
Some people may be listening to this on their way to their burn for the first time. And some may be friends and family who are like, I don't know about that.
Yeah.
With that in mind, what would be a win for you here?
Well, it's interesting, and this is where we came in right before we started recording, that in talking about this subject and the book I've written, the first thing I like to do is ask the audience, okay, how many people here are burners? How long have you been going? How familiar are you with this? Because that leads to very different conversations. And that's not something we can do in a format like this. Who knows who's going to be listening to it or who they're going to tell, hey, you should listen to this. So I guess what I would like to say for a home run interview is also what I think of as the two most important elements of Burning Man philosophy. And because I think that's different than saying, oh, we're going to have a talk about philosophy or we're just going to talk about ideas or culture. Burning Man culture itself points philosophy and points thinking about Burning Man in a couple of different directions than you normally would. And the first one is, and so this is the first thing I'd say, this should be the home run interview. This should be fun.
Yeah,
we should have fun doing it. Right.
Yes, and there's some stuff about Burning Man that I want to shore up in my, this will be my 10th year. Mm-hmm. I know you've been going a bit longer around the same time.
Just a little longer, yeah.
But for me, reading your book, I was like, oh, I might try that. So
fantastic.
It should be fun and also informational, but in the fun way.
Absolutely.
Right?
Now, we do this for its own sake. We want a culture of fun. We want to enjoy ourselves. We want to our culture at every level to be something where people are not afraid to laugh and enjoy themselves. And that means that the way we talk about it and the way we think about it should have that baked right in. It should be a part of it. If we're talking about Burning Man and we're afraid to laugh or, no, this is too serious, we're doing it wrong. We're just doing it wrong. Yeah, it should be that way. And the way we think about it, the way we talk about it, that should be fun too. So that's the first thing. We should just be enjoying ourselves. The second thing is that, okay, so what is the point of even having a discussion about Burning Man, which is something that, as everybody will tell you, I can't really tell you what it is. You have to experience it. And that partially makes me roll my eyes because I think that's an excuse. I think that's, you know, us not really trying very hard. But there's also really something to that. You know, it is an experience that you have to have. And in fact, I think, and this is something I talk about in the book, the fundamental unit of meaning at Burning Man is not words, it's not abstract ideas, it's actions, it's what you do, it's the experience you're having. Going from there, we can't really tell other people, this is what your experience is like, nor should we. We can't tell people, this is what it means to you, this is what you're going to be experiencing. We have to let that happen and have them have their own experiences and interpret that. So what's the point of having a conversation about Burning Man philosophy? It's not, that means it's not to be right. The idea is not to get the right answer. My understanding of Burning Man is deeper than yours. Good for you. That's not it at all. It's to be helpful. If people are listening to this and Burning Man becomes more accessible to them, the experience becomes more accessible to them, whether they've never been, whether they've been once, whether they've been 10 times, whatever they're dealing with in Burning Man, if we are helpful, if as a result of this conversation, they go, oh, there's something else I want to try. There's something else I never thought about trying to do this. This could be helpful with a problem I'm wrestling with. Then we've succeeded. Whether we're right or not about the abstract issues, the big issues, if we're helpful, if we make things accessible, that's a home run.
One of the things that I really enjoyed about your book was that you attempted to not simply describe your understanding of Burning Man philosophy, but to actually do it in the book. There are a number of times in the book that you're pretty self-referential and like, can I do what I'm doing? Does this work? I recall in one moment you listed a bullet point review of what had just occurred and what you'd just been writing about and said, I'm going to give you two lists. Here is a list of things that we've just discussed that are key features of creating a Burning Man space. I'm going to give you two lists. One of them is right and one of them is wrong. Yep. And you need to figure out which one.
Yes.
That was very cheeky of you.
Thank you. The whole point is that lists like that are something you put together because you don't really want to have the experience. You just want the executive summary. You want the short form.
And let me be clear. The lists are exactly the same.
Yeah.
And I looked over them a couple of times because I was like, is there some like cheek? They were exactly the same.
You just gave away my joke.
Then you have to, I guess, then you don't have to read the book. You have to just go to Burning Man now.
Yes, that's the best idea. And for those of you, if there is someone who is in fact on the road to Burning Man as they're listening to this with my book, planning to read it at Burning Man, let me try to discourage you from that. Do it if you want to. Feel free, but the book will be there when you get back. It really will. If reading it on the way to Burning Man, okay. Reading it after Burning Man, great. At Burning Man, be at Burning Man. If what you really want to do is read, okay, great. But be there. Do that thing. Have that experience.
The first year I went to Burning Man, I actually brought 10 books of philosophy that I could reference my experience. Yeah. And all I got from that was 10 dustier books.
No, me too, actually. My first couple of years, I kept bringing books going, yeah, no, I'm sure I'll get around to reading at some point. And no, I never have. I've never read a book at Burning Man. I do know somebody who does. I do know a couple of people who actually will, as their way of trying to shut everything off for a while and get out of the maelstrom of activity, curl up with a book, and that'll be their self-care meditative practice to get back into it later. And okay, if that's what they're doing, great. But yeah, no, I've never been able to actually read a book at Burning Man.
So the goal of the podcast is to have fun, which is great, which I appreciate, and to make Burning Man more accessible. And the goal of Burning Man philosophy is itself to make Burning Man more accessible. It's not about how you even apply Burning Man to your outside world per se, or how to burn correctly. So in the book, you talked about some of your colleagues say, well, if you want to start talking about Burning Man, you start with the 10 principles. But that's not what you did. That's not what you're into. You want to start with the experience and then talk about the principles at the end.
Yeah. And let me be clear. If you only have 5 minutes to talk to somebody about Burning Man, or if you have to make an elevator pitch, the principles are a pretty good way to start. If that's all you've got, then sure, go right to that. And we've got these 10 principles, because that's all the time you have. But if you have the time to do it right, if you can genuinely say, all right, let me tell you about this, then I think it's really important not to start with the 10 principles, because the 10 principles weren't there at the beginning. This was not something that people came to do because they had 10 great principles. They're like, how can we make these 10 principles work? What if we go to the desert and burn a man? That's a great idea. No, they created an experience. And after almost 20 years, I think some 18 or so years of doing it, finally, they said, okay, what is this? How can we distill this? The 10 principles actually emerged because in 2004, the regional network said, yeah, we're having a really hard time explaining what this is to the people in our own communities. Could you help us out here? Could you give us something? So the experience of Burning Man came before. The principles were meant to describe what the experience is. And so I think it's way better if you're trying to explain Burning Man to start with the nature of the experience, because the principles will emerge out of that. If you're explaining it at all, the principles will become clear through that explanation. And then they mean so much more than they do if you say, well, I've got these 10 principles. And then it's you're trying to cram the experience in to fit with the principles rather than have the principles emerge out of the experience.
So what is that experience? What does it mean to burn for you?
Well, a couple of things. And I mean, my personal unofficial definition of Burning Man, it's actually where the book really starts, practically the first page, is... I'm just going to read this verbatim here. What is Burning Man? My personal unofficial definition. Burning Man is a form of the social verb to burn. To burn is to establish a liminal space in which you create something amazing for its own sake, that anyone can actively participate in and even co-create, and then clean up after yourself when you're done. The official definition. There is no official definition of Burning Man, and anyone who thinks there is needs to be told a joke. For me, personally, when I think of what it is to burn, I think, okay, we create a space. We say, in this space, we're going to do something different. Culture is going to work differently for a while. And we go and find what is truly important to us. And we do that. We act on our intrinsic motivations. We do what we want to do for its own sake rather than out of an attempt to win or score points or get to some sort of extrinsic goal. Just create a space in which you can do what it is you are personally passionate about. Connect yourself to your inner drives and see what happens, and then get out of the way of other people who are doing that same thing and even offer to help. Honestly, I think there's no purer expression of Burning Man culture than to see a complete stranger doing something weird and amazing that you do not understand at all and then ask, can I help?
In terms of creating a space, there's this idea of taking away certain default ways of organizing and interacting with each other. And one of the things that I enjoyed in your book was this intersection of decommodification, self-reliance, and gifting, which are three of the principles. We're getting ahead of ourselves because I want to put principles at the end like you did. but this idea that if we're not interacting on the basis of money and status and power, and you can argue that people are still doing that at Burning Man to a certain degree,
sure.
But if the structure of it doesn't rely on that, then the space is opened up and people tend to make some really interesting choices in that space.
Yeah.
One of them being gifting.
It's interesting. And this, to sort of jump to what it is that Burning Man has to offer community building, one of the things that we have discovered through Burning Man over time is indeed proof that even in the modern world, even in the postmodern condition of contemporary society, when people have the opportunity to do what they really want to do, when they start doing what it is they want to do for its own sake, one of the things they tend to do every time is eventually they get around to build communities. They form communities. They become social. And one of the primary aspects of that is to give gifts. That's such a fundamentally human thing to do. And it's interesting that the world that we live in has gotten really bad at it. Mass market consumerist Western culture has gotten really bad at giving gifts. It's a thing you do for holidays, for special occasions, because there's a designated time that you do it. It's a thing that you buy. It has a price tag put on it, and how good a gift it is depends on how high that is. This actually has nothing to do with the offering of a heartfelt gift to someone. And I know that I've had this conversation with a lot of people, actually had no idea how to give a gift before I came to Burning Man. Of course, I could buy somebody something for a holiday, for their birthday, for Christmas, whatever. But I was actually really bad at giving gifts, as I now understand it. The idea that there was a way that I could offer something entirely outside of commerce that would create a connection between us, a shared experience that would mean something deeply to another person, was something I had not personally really understood as even possible. I mean, it's sort of in an abstract way. Oh, yeah, no, that's a really good, meaningful gift. But no, really, really grasped. And to discover that, to see that, to be on the other side of that, getting a gift like that, that blew me away. That changed my whole perception of how I could relate to other human beings. And suddenly, it was a thing I wanted to do, too. Once you, this, everybody's different, but this is not uncommon. Once people have that experience, suddenly it's a thing they also want to do. How do I do that for somebody else? And so you try it, and fairly often you fail, and you try again. I like to say it took me about 8 years before I got really good at giving gifts.
One of the reasons I really like to spend time with burners, and I spend a lot of time with burners, this idea of gifting elevates the experience of abundance for everyone, in the sense that if things are kind of leaning non-transactional, then there's just a chance that you might get what you need without having to have this scarcity mentality of mm-hmm. going and getting it yourself. And I feel like one of the things that Burning Man has given me, and I, by the way, I really resonate with this idea that the principles are something that evolves over time for you, mm-hmm. that it's like a skill that you build.
Yeah.
One of the things that's been really rich for me is this idea of living in more abundance because I'm around people who are freely flowing their gifts, freely flowing their energy mm-hmm. and their participation with each other.
Yeah.
It's one of the things that came out really strongly in the book to me was there's a bit of a methinks the lady doth protest too much. It's one of those moments. How much you eschewed this idea of transformation and the Hallmark card of transformation. And yet, so much of the story is about your own transformation through the experience of Burning Man, kind of in a slow burn rather than...
Well, that's part of it, is that I did not have one of those transformational experiences that everybody's talking about where you first go to Burning Man and, oh my God, my life is so different now. I went to Burning Man and went, oh yeah, I like that. That's neat. Kind of a rough desert you got here, but that's pretty amazing. But it wasn't like, oh, my life has changed. Everything is going to be different. So that was part of it. To the extent that I protest too much about that, I actually think it's really important. It's really, really important that we don't make the idea that someone has done Burning Man contingent on whether or not they've had a transformational experience. I think there's a real danger to saying, well, if you didn't have a transformational experience, you probably didn't do it right, which I think is implicit in the language of transformational experience that is so often attached to Burning Man. That if your consciousness wasn't raised and raised by at least 30%, then clearly you're underperforming. No. That's such bullshit. And so part of the message for me there to convey is that, no, you don't have to have an experience like that to get something out of this or to be a full participant or to be doing it right. That's not the measure. That's not the yardstick. It's just something that often happens to people. Then there's another way in which I wanted to protest to that degree because I wanted to make sure it wasn't bullshit. And that was my personal set of issues. But I'm one of those people who, before I could possibly have accepted this, I needed to road test it, to stress test it, to put it through all the ringers I had. Otherwise, I wasn't going to believe it. And maybe this just is about me, but I'm one of these people who believes that enlightenment won cheaply is just cheap.
There's definitely a culture in Burning Man today that is around personal development and transformation. And it's quite fetishized in the transformational experience. And you tell a story early on in your book that not only was a delightful story, but actually made me think a little bit about my trajectory at Burning Man, which is the story about the Rockstar Librarian Guide.
Oh, yes.
And I don't know if you'd like to give a short synopsis of that story, but there was a collision of different kinds of Burning Man ethos in that story that was really interesting to me because it reminded me of how Burning Man was when I first started and how it feels to me now. And that collision is something I've experienced in myself.
Yeah, it's kind of amazing when you think about it that a event whose early iterations included fast cars and drive-by shooting ranges is now the single most significant new age transformational pilgrimage site in the world. How did that happen? And okay, we could walk back and say this and this, but really, it's just kind of amazing to compare then and now in some ways. The story you're talking about, yeah, this was sort of a real collision moment for me too. I was hanging out at BMIR, the Playa radio station, 94.5, and which is my home away from home there. And they're one of the locations where the Rockstar Librarian Guide is provided. And for those who don't know, the Rockstar Librarian is a person, and she makes a guide that is as comprehensive as possible of all the various DJs and bands and things that are performing on Playa, and distributes them as a gift out. And since she can't possibly print personally 70,000 of these things, she will give them to various points so that can serve as distribution points and has only one per camp. So try to make sure everybody who needs it can get one. It's a wonderful gift. And people were coming through and trying to get them. And as a prank, the station manager at the time said that, we don't have any more, we're out. But caveat, pointing to me, is the human Rockstar Librarian Guide database. He has all the information in his head. And he kept trying to convince people to do this and that they should take me back to their camp to be their Rockstar Librarian Guide. And of course, everybody eventually went, oh, come on, no, what are you talking about? Until these two girls went, yeah, okay, we'll do that. And then there was this pause because we're like, what happens now? Nobody's ever said yes before. But so we went along with it. And, you know, Burning Man prank tradition, I, you know, started going back to their camp with them. And it was very clear that we were from these two different traditions of Burning Man. And I was literally walking out of the prankster environment to go to their camp, which was New Age Transformational. And we didn't make it to their camp because before we even got there, we got into this thing where our two worlds collided. And there was sort of an explosion, and it ended as well as it possibly could have for nobody understanding what was going on.
What I recall from the story is that you're going back and forth, you're trying to hold on to the prank, they're realizing it's a prank and not particularly liking it, and then suddenly one of the women has an aha moment where she says, mm-hmm. Oh, I'm being defensive, and her friend says, oh, you're being defensive, and they start to have their transformational trajectory of, oh, my lesson is happening now, I'm having this transformation, and meanwhile you're like, well, I'm just trying to prank you. and what was really interesting is you at the end of the story, they like hugged you and you kind of wished that they had actually been pranking you back.
Yeah.
That it was, oh, try sincerity, he'll hate that.
Yeah.
This intersection of pranking and transformation, to me, going to Burning Man this year, when I started, I went with a bunch of silly people, and we had a little sound camp, and we did weird stuff, and it was all about being weird.
Yeah.
And over the course of the decade that I've been going, I've definitely gotten swept up in this personal development. What is my lesson this year going to be? Mm-hmm. And it was such a treat to read what you were writing because I was like, I just want to go do pranks and stuff.
Yeah, that's just it. I can tell you after all these years of road testing and stress testing and being a cynical bastard about it, that transformational experiences are real. They really do happen. They are profoundly affecting. But I think they really do emerge out of that playful spirit. I think the more you try to grab hold of a transformational experience and say, okay, I am going to transform now, the less authentic it becomes. And the more it is just, you know, a costume piece that is tacked on that you're wearing. And at that point, what's really the point? Now, I think the transformational experiences happen in part because so much else is going on and because we are not all trying to fit in a certain transformational mold. I think that creates the sort of freedom and space and play that we all need to do this. And then whether it happens or not, you're having an amazing experience regardless.
And you are an agent to other people's experiences no matter what you think is happening. So
that's exactly what happened, I suspect, in that story we're talking about, was that, yeah, for me, this was an experience of pure bullshit and pranking that went horribly wrong. but they may very well have gotten an authentic moment of personal realization and transformation out of it. And who am I to say they didn't? Quite the contrary. Yeah, no, this is one of the amazing things about Burning Man, and actually about life in general, is just so heightened at Burning Man, is that we really have no idea who we are to one another, that we have these effects on people, on each other, that we almost never find out about, that change lives. We are all the instruments of massive change in each other's lives, for good or for ill, or just for wonder and amazement, and we often don't even know.
Well, and I think that the commercial interaction between people interrupts our ability to be an unexpected change agent. You know, if someone says, I want to give you this thing, and you're like, okay, I got to donate to their church, or like, we have these ideas of what a human interaction is going to be, and that creates this barrier to what it could possibly be.
Yeah, people talk about the gift economy and decommodification all the time as though these were really economic things. That no, we're trying to build an economic engine that is more just, that therefore doesn't rely on market forces. And to my mind, that really misses the point. You do not get a real economy in the way that I think economy actually matters out of gifting and decommodification. And it also implies that if society were economically just, then commodification would be okay and we wouldn't need to give gifts. I think that's so wrong. I think that it's a gifting culture because that actually does just what you said. It enhances our ability to connect with each other and have authentic experiences with each other and be present in meaningful ways for each other. And that's something we'd want to do regardless of how wealth is distributed. There is no distribution system of wealth where it would still be okay to commodify one another, to turn one another into things or objects for our own use. That would not be okay. It is a way in which we treat other people as human beings. That is what decommodification, to my mind, is really about. And similarly with gifting, it is a way that we connect with other people. We give one another experiences. We share of ourselves. And again, that actually has very little to do, to my mind, with how goods and services move around an economy. It has to do with the way in which we humanize one another, the way in which we offer things to one another, the way in which we're able to be present with one another. That makes such a difference. And for me, none of the profound gifts that I have gotten have been terribly practical. I mean, don't get me wrong. People have given me water out in the desert that has been really helpful at times. And it is wonderful to know that you're in an environment where if you need something practical, someone will probably step up. Even though we should be as radically self-reliant as possible, that makes this possible. But all of the profound gifts, all the gifts that I can look back on and go, wow, that was amazing, were not practical. They were experiences. They were moments. They represented a moment of connection for me with another human being. They represented an aha moment where suddenly I was able to see the world differently. All of them were experiences. That takes it out of the question of goods and services and swag and into the realm of the deeply human and connecting.
So I want to shift a little bit and talk about you and your experience. And one of the things that came up in this book is that you're very open about yourself. And I want to read something here because I think it's meaningful. Because the truth, my honest confession, is that I often get very depressed at Burning Man. Mm-hmm. By the time you read this, I will have gone to Burning Man more than 12 times, and I average about 2 major existential crises each time. So that's at least 24 massive depressive episodes full of fear and shame and self-loathing, abetted by the absolute conviction that everyone else around me is making the most of this incredible opportunity, that everyone else is having fun and sexy transformative experiences, and I am falling behind, have already fallen behind, have wasted my life, am unlovable and broken and unworthy because this place is obviously magic, and why isn't it happening for me?
Yeah.
It's beautiful that you wrote that. I've felt that at Burning Man. Mm-hmm. Do you consider yourself someone who suffers from depression?
I would say not clinically. I do not suffer from what would be regarded as clinical depression. I have certainly suffered from what I think we could regard as existential depression, from the not medicalized sense of despair in life, that I am doing something wrong, that I am lonely, that I am alienated. Those have absolutely been themes in my life, yeah.
I have also suffered from depression, and mm-hmm. at various times I consider it clinical and sometimes I don't because I try to stay away from the clinic part of it. Yeah. I'd rather do the transformational experience and hope that works. But it does sound, you know, it sounds like just this passage itself sounds to me like the recursive escalating thought pattern of depression, in that it's not simply that you're not making the most of this incredible opportunity. It's not simply that you've fallen behind. It's you've already fallen behind. You've wasted your life, like unlovable and broken and unworthy.
Yeah.
There's a kind of escalating experience, and it reminds me of my own recursive thinking that I have called depression in my life mm-hmm. at various stages. And I appreciate that you have been so open about that in this book and saying that it's okay to be miserable at Burning Man. It's okay to have a bad experience. A lot of people go to this place of wonder and whimsy and magic, and I think have not only a miserable experience, but a compounded loneliness in thinking yeah. that they are the one who is doing it wrong because yeah. it feels so bad.
Yeah, no, that's... One of the sections of the book is actually called It's Okay to Be Miserable at Burning Man, and that's actually based on a piece that I wrote for Burning Man's website many years ago, which is, I think, the single most useful thing I've ever written about Burning Man.
They reposted it this week.
Oh, did they really?
Yeah. It's on the... And I saw it this week on Facebook.
Ah. Well, that explains why people have brought that up recently. Yeah. No, I really do think that's the single most important thing and helpful thing I've ever written about Burning Man, is just saying that there is such a powerful way in which being out in this environment, when people think about the transformational experience at the bullshitty level that we've been talking about, you know, that, oh, well, it's just a thing that this idea that transformational experience is a thing that automatically happens to you.
Or that it happens in a way that you expect it.
Right.
Like the transformation is the bad thing will go away and the good thing will come.
Exactly. It's on cue. It's on time. You can check your watch by it. Oh, yeah, it's Thursday at 3 p.m. I guess I'm going to have that transformational experience now. That is not how this works at all. On the contrary, this environment does not solve your problems for you. It brings them up. It's very much that case of those demons that you do not face on the inside, you will have to face on the outside. I've never seen an environment in which that dynamic is more powerful and obvious than Black Rock City, where, you know, whatever is haunting you within will in fact be an issue you have to grapple with on the outside. And you can handle that however you want to handle it, including running away from it, including denying it. You know, those are all options you've got. But what I discovered in the process of my own explorations, and I think this is pretty true for people across the board, is that it only transforms if you can admit it, if you can be open about it, if you can start to say, yes, this is in fact what I am feeling. And for my own self, I really, really have discovered that the faster I can do that, the faster it changes. But that the more I am trying to convince other people and myself, no, I'm having a great time. This is amazing. I am enjoying every moment of this. I'm not at all feeling left out. That just prolongs it. That locks it in. And I become my own jailer at that point, trying to hold these feelings in. But when I can admit it, when I can get them out there, that's when change is possible. That's when things get interesting.
Well, and I think that's possible in part because this idea that you bring up in the book, that you're not a passive consumer of life mm-hmm. when you're at Burning Man. If I have a problem and I'm not listening to it and I'm not listening to my gut and I know something's wrong, but I can just be in my routine and watch TV and yeah. I can be anesthetized in this what Guy Debord called the spectacle. Is that mm-hmm. his own?
Guy Debord, yeah.
Guy Debord. I'm yeah. sorry, Guy. But... Guy Debord.
He was a terrible human being by all accounts, so
okay,
don't feel
well,
bad.
Okay, well, fuck you then, Guy Debord. Yeah. So that's where we've gotten to on the podcast, is fuck you, Guy Debord. there's a passivity that allows you to stay in the same patterns. And even if you're organizing yourself to your own personal development, mm-hmm. and I know many people like this, and I myself have been this way and am this way in many ways. If you're a transformational junkie, you can hide in that pattern.
Yeah.
You can hide within leaping from peak experience mm-hmm. and not actually address what needs to come out of you. But Burning Man seems to, maybe it's the nature of the extreme environment, maybe it's the serendipity of the space, it seems to kind of strip things away and let that pus bubble up.
I think it's in some ways another aspect of decommodification. I think it was Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche who talked about spiritual materialism. It's this way in which we collect blessings and meditations and senses, approaches to enlightenment, as if they were merit badges that they could wear, as if they're things that, oh, well, this teaching, I'll just pull this one and I'll add this one. And I have these teachings, so aren't I so much more enlightened now and therefore better than you? There's this way in which that also becomes a commodity and a form of commodification. And Burning Man, yeah, is very good at getting through that. I think it's that this wonderful combination of the sacred and the profane, the utterly irreverent in this environment in which it is actually possible to feel that everything is sacred.
Well, and that's exactly why I was so revivified by reading about pranking. Because I forgot that I went to Burning Man to be dumb and silly and ridiculous and wear sparkly tights. Because when I went to Burning Man wearing sparkly tights, I was challenging my gender norm in a way that was scary for me and weird and silly. Now I'm challenging my gender norm in a way that's hip and cool. Oh, you're wearing sparkly tights. Everybody's wearing sparkly tights because that's, you're a man, and being a man is about being vulnerable. And isn't it so interesting how we can become complacent? And I think even with Burning Man, become complacent. And so just, I mean, just thank you for this book and for reminding me that we need to fuck around.
Thank you so much. Yeah, no, it's absolutely right. I can tell you that for me, 2013 was the year when I was sitting there going, the magic is not happening. I don't know what this is. And I realized it's because I was in a rut. I was taking it for granted. All I was doing was going from camp to camp where I knew people and knew exactly what would happen. And sure, they were my friends and I was having a pretty good time just going there, but I wasn't actually experimenting or pushing myself or meeting strangers or doing any of the things that had made it so magical. And so I had to get out of my own rut. I had to push myself to say, okay, I'm going to go off into this part of the city where I have no idea what's going to happen next or who I'm going to meet, and I'm just going to see what happens. And as soon as I did that, boom, suddenly, yeah, there was weirdness and magic and serendipity again. But yeah, no, we can become passive about all of this too.
Could it be the case that Burning Man itself is in a bit of a rut? And could that be why Marianne has come out with this cultural course correction and there's a lot of voices saying, okay, we need to make a shift in Burning Man culture as a whole? Would you say that's the case or possibly the case?
I think it's a danger. I think that there are outside pressures trying to make Burning Man, put Burning Man in a rut and make it predictable. Listen, on the one hand, if it's okay to be miserable about Burning Man is the most helpful thing I ever wrote about Burning Man. The most popular thing I ever wrote about Burning Man came out about 2 years ago, and it's called A Brief History of Who Ruined Burning Man.
Oh, I totally read that. Yeah. I didn't realize you'd written. That's a great piece.
Thank you. And yeah, and for to give away the punchline, it's a year-by-year breakdown of who ruined Burning Man this year. Until
Can you give some of those? Actually, that's a pretty funny trajectory. Can you tell us some of the, not necessarily the exact year, but some of the trajectory of who ruined Burning Man?
Sure. It's, first of all, it was strangers coming in, people we didn't know coming in. They ruined Burning Man. Then it was DJs and sound camps, and they came in and they ruined Burning Man. And then it was New Age transformative people, and then it was the Burning Man old guard who were so angry about it that every year it's somebody. And eventually, because sometimes Burning Man gets ruined by multiple people in the same year, you realize that Burning Man out of 33 years has been ruined 39 times. So there's this perpetual sense that, oh no, something's about to happen. It's about to go bad. Something's wrong. And so part of me thinks there's just a panic reaction there. I think that case is overstated. That said, there are genuine issues, and this is going to be a perpetual problem. And in fact, let me be clear that I don't think this is a solvable problem in the big sense that you do something and then you don't have to worry about it again. I think the nature of this problem is that in order to be kept fresh, it has to be kept fresh year after year after year after year. We have to keep doing it if we want it to be active and engaged. And in fact, one of the things that Larry once said that really has stuck with me, I quote him at the end of the book with this, is that his fear is that Burning Man will go from being something that is discovered to something that is received.
Tell me more about that.
The idea being that if it's discovered, you are discovering it. And that is an active process for you. That you are saying, oh, let me see what this is. Oh, what is this? I have to explore this. I have to look at this. And that's a very different process from receiving something where somebody says, here's the thing, it's all full, it's all done. You don't have to do anything. You just have to, again, at that point, it's like a costume piece. You just wear it. It's the difference between doing Burning Man and wearing Burning Man.
And that's one of your critiques of so-called transformational festivals, that they give you, this is the lineup, these are the things, go to the thing, and then have your transformation.
It's totally different from creating the experience yourself, from co-creating the experience yourself. And so in that sense, no, there is I think the fears of Burning Man being in a rut are overblown, but I think the worry about Burning Man being in a rut is very legitimate. And so I think that's exactly why we need things like the cultural course correction, that we need things like a perpetual revisiting of, okay, what are we doing that's made it too easy on ourselves, or that has gotten us stuck here, or that is keeping new people from being able to access this and bring their own creativity and weirdness and idiosyncrasies to our collective endeavor.
Why do you think so many people hate Burning Man?
It's really interesting. I really got it when I had started publishing on Burning Man's website and writing articles, and then occasionally seeing mainstream media reaction to it. And I suddenly realized there's this whole bunch of people who really want us to fail. They are actively hoping that we fall on our asses and are exposed as some kind of giant, stupid, nebulous fraud. And they really want that. And it was shocking for me to be staring that full in the face. It's like, well, we're trying to do something good. Why would you want us to fail? It's okay that it's not your thing, sure, but why would you want us to fail that hard? There are people who are just waiting to prove that, to see us go down so they can prove, see, this is impossible. And I think that's it. And I have to confess that this might be part of my journey too. Because like I say, when I first started, I thought transformational experience, the whole transformational thing was probably bullshit. And I'm the sort of person who was very cynical about it and had to really wrestle with it before I would believe it. And if it hadn't had that kind of impact on my life, I don't know that I would have. I think there is, maybe this goes back to what we were saying earlier about emotional abundance and emotional scarcity. I think that there are times when you are living in a world of emotional scarcity that it's important to you to justify to yourself that it has to be this way. And I think that was something that I suffered from at the time and to some extent still struggle with. That
there may be, in addition to that, the idea that not that you would want the scarcity, but that someone who seems to be demonstrating something else would be, by their very nature, not only a fraud, but the worst kind of self-righteous hypocrite who's saying, oh, I have abundance. Fuck you. Right. Abundance is just code for privilege. And that I think there's an animosity, especially because Burning Man is expensive the ticket is expensive. There's a scarcity of tickets even to get there.
Yeah.
And, you know, you're taking this time off your life. And then you add to that all these fleets of RVs and people flying into to Burning Man. And like any place, there are people who attend Burning Man who are living lives that are somewhat garish. And to be told, I'm better than you because of this party, I think that that's part of the energy that I've experienced.
No, and anybody who says I'm better than you because of this party is absolutely full of it. That is a bullshit statement of the highest order. And similarly, it's worth pointing out that fairly often abundance is a code for privilege. That is a real thing. That is a thing that happens, and it is horrible. So, to that extent, if anybody is being that self-righteous about Burning Man, and we know that they are, yeah, fuck them. Yeah, I'm on the side of the doubters at that point. I think it's really important for us to be clear. Going to Burning Man doesn't make us better than anybody else. It absolutely doesn't. It's a thing we do for its own sake, because we want to do it. And our thing doesn't necessarily make us any better than anybody else. No, I really object to that language of abundance as a code for privilege myself. But there is also a way in which people who are looking at this from the outside saying you couldn't possibly be enjoying yourself that much, you couldn't possibly be having a meaningful emotional experience, that kind of society is not possible. I think there's a way in which consumer culture needs to justify itself by saying there is no other alternative. There is no other alternative. There could be no other way to give gifts than guided by market forces when it's appropriate via holidays, looking at the price tag as being the only way. It matters to consumer culture that there not be alternatives, and therefore it tries to appropriate whatever alternatives are out there and then strike down what it cannot appropriate. That's a real dynamic, and that's ugly. And I think you see versions of that in interpersonal dynamics as well, that people who feel as alienated as we all do sometimes, as I certainly have sometimes, have that option of saying nobody else could possibly feel more connected and anybody who does is lying. That our misery has to justify itself sometimes. And I think it's, to take it back to Larry for a moment, he was a profoundly alienated man. He was a very lonely man for much of
his
life.
And he iconically says that he didn't trust people.
Yeah. Another thing that Larry said to me all the time, or that I will always remember as being one of his key statements, was, let's not pretend to be better than we are. Let's not pretend that. No, he was a profoundly isolated, alienated person for much of his life. And his response to that was not to try to say nobody else could have connection, or to try to create a world in which it was just that alienation was justified, but to create Burning Man. For me, that is a parable of our time. That is the opposite reaction. That is saying, I may not have this, but I'm going to try to be helpful for people. And that's when Burning Man helps people do that, that is a profoundly beautiful and meaningful thing. But there is also that way, but that is also a choice that you make. Instead of trying to justify your misery, it's trying to be helpful instead.
Talking about privilege and abundance is a good inroad to something I wanted to chat with you about, mm-hmm. which you wrote an article in 2012 called Is Burning Man a White People Thing?
Right.
This is actually when you came on my radar, and that was a really compelling article for me, and it influenced something that I ended up writing about Africa Burn down the road. And that's a thorny issue because I explored it myself, but this idea... In many ways, Burning Man has in its history been kind of a white people thing. Can you speak a little bit to why it's been that way and whether it's changing and how?
Yeah, no, this is a really tough issue. And it's also an issue that has no easy answers to it. But in the first place, it's a white people thing because of the context that it came out of. San Francisco in the 1970s and 80s, counterculture was very much a white people thing. And the groups that it came out of, the Suicide Club, the Cacophony Society, Larry and his friends, as he called them, Bohemian Carpenters, they were, to my knowledge, you know, almost entirely groups of white people hanging around being countercultural. And the privilege to be countercultural in that way was a very white thing at the time. You look at what was happening in white counterculture in the 60s, 70s, and you know, then when Burning Man first began through 1986, it was let your free flag fly. Find your individuality. Find your transcendence. Let's expand our consciousness. The counterculture that minority cultures were going through was, let's have equal rights. Let's have equal access to institutions. Let's have our personhood recognized by the legal system and by the cultural apparatuses. Those are very different struggles. And put simply, it's not at all clear to me that what the Suicide Club and the Cacophony Society and Larry and his friends were doing in those earlier years was at all relevant to that struggle. I think we do a disservice to everyone if we try to pretend that it was. It's not that they were doing something wrong or bad, but it wasn't all that relevant to the struggle to get access to the ballot or access to live in neighborhoods, to have your personhood recognized by the system. It was a different kind of struggle. And so what that meant was that for much of Burning Man's early period, when it was spread by word of mouth, first of all, that word of mouth wasn't going to reach communities of color, minority communities. And secondly, that it might very well not look particularly relevant because it might very well not be particularly relevant. There were also, not to put too fine a point on it, a lot of danger signs. You're going to go out to a remote location with a bunch of crazy white people who will be drunk or stoned, and especially in the early years, have guns, and they're going to burn stuff. That just sends up red flags to communities of color, and rightfully so. So there were all these ways in which Burning Man just either didn't appear relevant or wasn't going to get on their radar or was going to have red flags when it started to. And it's only when it really started to penetrate mass media consciousness that the dynamic started to change. And it's changing, but it's changing slowly, and it's changing in weird ways. And that's, in some ways, weirdness is just inevitable here. But I think there's a big and very well-meaning push to diversify Burning Man for the sake of saying, yeah, diversity, great, we're going to do this, it'll be good. And diversity is great, and it is good. But I think there's a tone deafness to that, too. Because I think the idea that, oh, well, if we just throw Burning Man at people of color, they'll come and they'll see how great we are, is a way of assuming that we are in fact relevant, that this is a, that our thing necessarily will be their thing because our thing is so great. And as a, and I just, that seems tone deaf to me. That seems like it's not listening. It seems like we still need to ask the question, are we in fact relevant? Are we in fact, is this in fact something that will make, is this in fact something that they will want to engage with for its own sake, the way we want to engage it with it for its own sake? And if not, then we should be able to first take, respect a no for an answer instead of going, no, you're just not listening. You just don't get how great we are. And then ask why not? What can we do to help? What are we not offering? What are we missing? What are we not seeing? I think in many ways, the push to diversify Burning Man has not asked those questions yet. And that's, those are the right questions to ask.
Well, and Larry Harvey famously said that we don't do quotas, which I really respect. When I was chatting with the folks who do the regional in Africa, in South Africa, Africa Burn, it's in Africa and it's a lot of white folks.
Yeah.
And they were discussing the idea that you can't invite someone into an experience so that they can be the token of their culture in that experience because they can't have an experience. They're there as a token. This is obviously tokenism. There are these kind of white savior energies that are really pernicious, albeit well-meaning, that actually are far worse. And it ends up being a thorny problem. And I think that one of the important things is that it's a conversation that the Burning Man community has and is continually willing to have. And to your point, is willing to listen. And I think the demographics have changed, certainly in Nevada.
They have gotten better.
But it's a tricky subject, and I really appreciated that you were writing about it at that time. And it seemed like a lot of the feedback, a lot of the comments on that article were people happy that the conversation was moving forward.
In many ways, this has sort of been my function within the Burning Man intellectual ecosphere, is that I've had the ability to have difficult conversations that are unofficial but still out there and public. And I think that's actually been, I think it's really useful for the community to be, and the culture to be able to do that. I got a great sense of, okay, let's talk about this after I published that. And I think that I know I've done my work well when I have that response from people. This is something that I've written that, okay, yes, let's talk about this.
And that's exactly what you lay out in your new book here, is that if this is a book full of answers, it's the wrong book. You know, it should be a book that invites more question. And a little more than halfway through the book, you kind of stumble on one of the challenges of a project like this book, which is if you are merely descriptive in a way that would work for burners generally, you're very much playing it safe. And that part of burning, part of taking the personal agency and participation is to actually take some risk.
Yeah.
How do you feel you executed that in the book? Do you feel like you were able to take some risks? How do you think that project panned out?
It's interesting. When I finished the book, and to give a bit of context about this, I was offered the book contract almost exactly as Larry went in, had his stroke and went into his coma. And then I had to start writing it shortly after he died. He and I were very close. We were friends. We worked on this together. This was his life's work. There was an enormous personal difficulty around writing this book about his life's work just after his death. And when I had finished it and sent it off to the publisher, and in fact, then got a one-way ticket to Europe and put my entire life down and went away for a while, I had this very clear sense that, okay, I've done it. I was asked to do this impossible thing, and I did my work, and I did it well, and I knocked it out of the park, and nobody could have done it better, and it's good. I did it right. I did it the way it should be done. And I felt that way until about 2 weeks before the book came out, when all of a sudden it occurred to me that I had screwed everything up and this was terrible. And what was I thinking? And I had embarrassed Larry and his legacy.
That sounds like Burning Man.
Yeah, no. It's, I don't know. I think all I can really say about that is that for me, there, you said it earlier, there is personal disclosure in this book. It's not a book about me, but I don't know that it would have been possible to really convey what has to be conveyed about Burning Man in the sort of third-person abstract way. So there's a lot of me in it. And so in that sense, I did feel that I was taking risks. And look, I didn't have to write about Burning Man's diversity issues in the book. I didn't have to propose what economic models based on Burning Man might be. There were a lot of difficult subjects that I did not have to take on, that I chose to do so, in part because even if I am wrong about them, if I am demonstrating taking a risk and doing it well, then that is what people need to see that Burning Man helps you do. One of the things that I say about Burning Man is it's not a safe space. It's not safe, but it does take your risks and it lubricates them. It makes it easier to take risks and to recover from them when you do. And I do think that's what I was able to do in this book. But whether or not I did it well, for me, I don't think I could have done it better. I think I did as good a job as I could possibly have done. Whether it lives up to what it needs to do, that depends on people reading it. That depends on not how right it is, but how helpful people find it. And the most meaningful feedback that I have gotten has been from people saying, yeah, I sent copies of your book to my family and friends who are not burners so they could finally understand what the hell it is I've been doing all this time. Or this really spoke to my experience and suddenly I think I can do something differently. That's the feedback that really matters to me. That's where I say, okay, I got something right here. I did something right.
And just to pay you this compliment, I've been going for 10 years and this book was not only taught me things, but it was actually really timely for me. And I found that the book is actually, particularly this idea of coming back to the pranking and the roots of Burning Man, that it was challenging me to think more deeply about it. And one of the ways that I'm thinking more deeply about it is something that you talk about in talking about the principles, in that the principles are skills, and that you are developing them over time. And the principles are not this proscriptive 10 commandments, go do this to be a good burner. If you mess that one up, then you're a bad burner. But rather, it's descriptive of what people are doing when they're burning. And there are things that you can continue to explore and go deeper on.
Yeah, I had my 10th year a couple of years ago and did a little retrospective after that. And one of the things that I realized, and this is where this idea first really started to crystallize for me, was that it kept getting harder instead of easier. And that it was so much harder in some ways my 10th year than it had been my first year, just in completely different ways.
Ooh, I agree. Yeah, I agree. Right? That's been that way this past year.
Yeah, and that's because instead of getting good at something and then just doing it over and over again, we keep expanding our capacities and trying new things. It's not that the camping aspects are harder than they were, and I've gotten really good at those, or I'm actually really terrible at camping, but I've gotten better at those, but all the artistic aspects, instead of just resting on my laurels, I keep trying to do harder and harder things because I'm getting better and better at it. And so now I can try something new, and now I can try something new. And you see this happening all the time. One of the interesting dynamics about Burning Man is that the art has gotten so much bigger and so much more complex and so much more complicated. And people often attribute that to the money. Oh, there's so much money. But no, it's because there's no cost prohibition happening here. There's no minimum threshold that you have to spend money on to take art to Burning Man. And there's no demand. There's never been a demand from the organization to have bigger projects. It's people going, well, we did this last year. I bet we could do this year. Oh, look at what they did. That's pretty amazing, but I bet we could do this. We as a culture are constantly pushing our own limits and one-upping ourselves and taking what we have learned and these skills we have built and then try to do the next thing and the next thing. It took me about 8 years to get good at gifting, at giving, and I've tried to do something new and push that limit every time instead of just going, oh, now I'm good at it. Now I can stop. Yeah, no, it's the amazing thing about it is that we do not stop. We keep going and then we take these skills that we've learned and apply them to new challenges and new efforts and are constantly pushing our own boundaries that way. It's amazing and a pain in the ass.
So I have this idea in my mind that friends of mine and people I've never met are going to be listening to this podcast on their way to Burning Man. This is my vision. I'm like, you're on your way to Burning Man. You're driving. Oh, by the way, we once took the art car that we built to Burning Man. It's called Grandma's House. It was a tiny little purple grandmother's home. And we had it way overloaded. So if we were listening to this podcast on our way to Burning Man, we would be fearing for our lives and wondering like why on earth we thought we could get over those like trucky mountains, horribly overloaded purple grandma's house. But my vision is, this idea that I have is that folks are on their way to Burning Man, and maybe it's their first year and they're like, oh my God, I need to absorb everything about Burning Man. Or maybe it's their 15th year and they're like, I want something to make fun of on my drive over there. So whatever these guys think they're talking about, we're going to spend our time making fun of them.
Yeah.
If you could speak directly to someone on their way to Burning Man right now, and for whatever goal or whatever reason, what do you like to say to them? And I invite you to speak directly to them because they are listening. Are you listening? Have you faded out?
First, I'd have questions. I would actually want to listen before I spoke.
I can't do it with this format. I know, but do it with a podcast.
It makes a difference as to whether they're a first timer or whether they are that cynical, jaded fuck on their going on their 20th burn. There are a couple of people who will be celebrating their 25th year this year, including Marion, actually. I believe it's her 25th. I think I should double check that. It's different for everybody, but okay. I mean, first of all, it is okay to be miserable at Burning Man. I think that has to be said over and over again. All right. Hi. My name's Caveat. It's good to almost meet you this way. And I guess I want to say two things. The first of which is thank you. Because whatever you are going out there to do is going to make a difference. As long as you are offering something, as long as you are building something that anybody can pass through or perceive, as long as you are doing what you are doing out there, you are creating this city together. And it is that collective effort that makes it such an extraordinary place of whimsy and magic and ritual and transformation. So thank you. You will probably change my life in some way this year without us even knowing it. So thank you for that. Don't think it doesn't add up, because it really does. And then the other thing I would want to say is, I think the most helpful way to approach all of this is to be able to keep multiple ideas in your head at once and multiple perspectives. That on the one hand, this is a massively magical and transformational experience, and on the other hand, it's only Burning Man. That on the one hand, we may very well be changing the world, and on the other hand, we're just fucking around. That it is not in between these polarities, but the expression of both of them at once that really makes this what it is. It is not radical self-reliance as opposed to radical self-expression, but both of them at once. It is not communal effort as opposed to gifting, but both at once that make this happen. And so to the extent that you can keep multiple truths in your head and have them be equally true at the same time, that I think is probably the best way to approach this. And I hope that wasn't pretentious. Good luck with that.
You know, it's kind of a relief, actually, to think about it that way. It's Burning Man. It's finally Burning Man. It's Christmas for burners. And it's going to be so important. And I've got this big project, and I'm going to give a talk, and everyone's going to come. And then I'm going to build this big art piece, and everyone's going to love it. And that sounds just like torture. Jesus, oh the expectations. God,
right. Yeah.
But then it's like, I'm just going to go party for a week. That also sounds like pretty boring. Yeah. And to try to find some kind of tapioca, mediocre, lame middle point is also... I don't really want to do that. But I like the idea that it's like, this is going to revolutionize my relationship with my partner. And also, I hope we get through it alive. Yes. And maybe getting through it alive means thinking about it as just a thing we're doing together and not the intense deepening of our potential connection. And
right. Yeah, no, it's... There is a creative tension is something that I talk about a lot in the book. And there is a creative tension to all of this. It's not just a single thing. It's not just, it's quite literally not just one program or set of events that everybody's doing. It's a city of 70,000 people all going about their way, doing what they want to do, spreading their own individual weirdness, passion, and following their own intrinsic motivations. And there's also this way in a sort of an abstract sense that creative tension is just built into the thing. The 10 principles are in tension with one another. And the idea is not then to have them destroy each other or come to some tepid middle ground, but to express them all simultaneously. And how you do that is where the really interesting stuff comes in, and where the really interesting skill building happens, and where the really bizarre and terrifying and wondrous experiences happen. I've been recently writing a series of posts on, it started with transformational experiences, but it quickly turned into looking at transformational relationships. That the idea being that transformational experiences are certainly a thing that happens and are real and occur, but that much more routinely, it is our relationships with people that transform us and change us. And following in the footsteps of the pioneering American humanistic psychologist Carl Rogers, he proposed that some of the aspects of a truly transformational relationship, something that's really transformative, is that you have to have multiple kind of contradictory things going on. That transformative relationships are, on the one hand, profoundly honest. There's no bullshit. You always know where you stand with the person. They're not going to lie to you. And on the other hand, they have what he called unconditional positive regard. That it's a relationship with someone who believes in you and in your potential and is never going to turn away from you, no matter what you do, who's always going to have that ability to create a space for you and have them in their lives and will have unconditional positive regard for you. And those two things don't go together easily. On the one hand, honesty. You know, if you offend me, you need to know it. If you do something that I think is awful, I need to be willing to tell you. And on the other hand, unconditional positive regard, that I got you no matter what. And it's within those combinations of things, which don't cancel each other out, which don't factor each other out, but which are both true at once, that transformation happens, that a whole new person can emerge out of this. And I think Burning Man really embodies those tensions in all kinds of ways, that there are these multiple levels of things constantly happening. Art and ritual and play in all different directions are happening all the time. And it's in that mix of things that are all true and all bullshit and all happening that you're able to have this possibility occur that can be really, really amazing.
And that harkens back to the story of the Rockstar Librarian program, beginning of this conversation. Mm-hmm. The collision of pranking and personal development that somehow was greater than the sum of its parts. Because in a sense, that prank ended up featuring in your book. So yeah. It certainly was memorable for you.
I learned something from it. It wasn't the lesson I had gone out with. As a prank, I considered it a failure, but as a human experience, it was meaningful enough to me that I learned enough from it that I thought, yeah, this is a story worth sharing.
So you said in the book that we start with the experience and you end with the 10 principles.
Actually, no.
No?
No. You start with the experience, you end with thinking for yourself. The 10 principles are a tool that you use in order to help make it Burning Man, but you don't end with them.
The 10 principles. I have always felt that the 10 principles each kind of have a shadow opposite. Mm. Like each of the 10 principles, in some ways, there's a way that it expresses itself in its opposite. So for example, leave no trace. It's a great principle, but we leave a hell of a trace in the garbage dumps leaving Burning Man. Mm-hmm. It's decommodification, but everybody is at Target and Walmart buying way more things than they would buy if they were spending the week at home. Mm-hmm. All of these different things so that mm-hmm. they can participate. There's immediacy, but then you want to capture that Instagram post so that you can revisit that immediacy later on, which takes you out of the immediate moment that you might have later on. There's radical self-expression, but then there is somewhat of a Burning Man uniform. There's I have a sparkly disco hat. Like everybody I know has a sparkly disco hat. Obviously not everybody does, but there just seems to be, they seem to call forth their shadows in a way that I think is worth noting and also doesn't invalidate them. Mm. Kind of like what we were saying earlier about this kind of collision of opposites and this way that we're building skills and becoming aware of, if I'm all about this radical self-expression, how radical are my sparkly tights 10 years later? Mm. They felt pretty radical when I first put them on, but they don't feel so radical now. So in a way, the principles are kind of alive, and I've felt like these shadow opposites are part of the tension that you were mentioning in the book, this mm-hmm. creative tension that kind of keeps them alive, which is leave no trace means more in 2019 than it did in 1999 mm-hmm. because our planet is cooking in a much more rapid trajectory than we thought. And yeah. so Burning Man is even taking this an approach to being carbon neutral by 2025, I think, or 20?
I think it was 2030, but
2030?
I'd have to double check.
Yeah, this idea of the principles not as these kind of sacrosanct commandments that are fixed and that they are exactly what you think that they are, mm-hmm. but that they're at tension with each other and that yeah. they're alive and that they have, I think, a shadow opposite.
That's interesting. No one has ever put the idea of them having a shadow opposite to me before. I'm gonna have to mull on that. But there's absolutely, I mean, the first thing that I can say is that, yeah, because they are not commandments, you have to figure out how you want to engage with them. They are principles. They are things we value. If we have these 10 things going on, Burning Man happens. The experience of burning happens. But there's no checklist by which you can be doing it or not doing it. You have to ask yourself, as you did with your sparkly tights, am I really being radically self-expressive? 10 years ago, this was, yes, to put these on, that was radical self-expression for you. Is it really now? It's that's a legitimate question to ask, because it's not like there's a box you can check. Sparkly tights? Yes. Okay, great. I'm doing it. It's a question you keep asking yourself. Is this what I'm doing? Is this what I'm doing? Is radical self-reliance a similar thing? There was a period of time when, you know, I could not put up my own tent. That was a frontier for radical self-reliance for me. But if I can put up my own tent, does that mean I've stopped now? Or is there other things I can do to be even more self-reliant that now I can do that I couldn't before? That's what engaging with the principles means. That's why they are skills. That's why this develops. And it's also why you can't just tell somebody else, no, here's how you do it. This is how you have to do it. They have to do it for themselves. Sparkly tights may still be radically self-expressive for somebody.
Absolutely, right. Yeah.
On the other hand, there are people for whom they are clearly not. So what is it for them? We don't get to tell each other how we do it, but we can inspire each other. We can engage with each other. We can be helpful to each other. And that's fantastic. For, like I say, gifting, another thing, people often don't realize that it's possible to give gifts on this level or this way until somebody does it for them, until they're a recipient of a gift like that, at which point they're inspired. That's amazing. That's so much better than telling them, here's how you have to give, which is not only less effective, but also contradictory past a certain point. If everybody has to give gifts a certain way, is it really a gift or is it a routine? Similarly for radical self-expression. If there's only one way to do radical self-expression, then the people who aren't doing it are actually being more radically self-expressive. It's something that you have to engage with and figure out for yourself. It cannot be a commandment. It has to be something that is communicated through inspiration and ideas, and even trying and failing and learning how to do it next time.
Africa Burn has an 11th principle, mm-hmm. which is each one teach one. Mm-hmm. And folks have talked about how there should be an 11th principle, and that principle is consent. Have you mm-hmm. heard this conversation?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and in the book, you make a pretty good case for why there should not be an 11th principle. Mm-hmm. Now, I know this might be a little bit controversial because this idea of consent, whether it's not to get sprayed with water or any kind of yeah. human interaction between people, that people are like, we need an 11th principle. Can you tell me why we don't need an 11th principle?
I think that the arguments for an 11th principle often proceed from the assumption that the 10 principles are like laws of physics, that if you discover one, then it is good throughout the universe for all people for all time. That's not how it works. The 10 principles are the things that we have discovered that we need in order to reach that state of burning, in order to reach that Burning Man experience. And I think it's perfectly legitimate to ask, should there be an 11th principle? But what you're asking for is not in general, not for everybody, but for me and for my community. If a community has such a problem with consent that they cannot get to the experience of Burning Man, then yes, they probably do need an 11th principle of consent. But that doesn't mean that other communities need it in the same way. The example that I like to use is Los Angeles has proposed a 11th principle of gratitude. This comes out of the LA Burning Man community periodically. I think LA actually really does have a gratitude issue. I think for people in Hollywood, gratitude is actually a really good thing to remember. And it may very well be that their community has such a problem with it that this is a thing they need to make sure they do. But does that mean that every community has that need to get there? And I think the answer is not only no, but that if the 10 principles starts to become a list of all the things that we just think are good in the world, then we start to lose it. We know that we can get to the experience of Burning Man through these 10 principles. If there is something that your community is so struggling with that it needs another principle to remind you, no, we have to do this if we're going to get here, then okay, but that's what you need. That's what you're doing. But once the 10 principles become a list of just all the stuff we think is good in the world, hey, patience is really good. We should all be patient. We should all be nice to each other. We should all learn a second language. We should all know how to code. At that point, it's meaningless. The 10 principles are not meant to describe everything good and true and useful in the world. They're meant to describe how Burning Man culture works and how you get to that experience. And they do that really well. But the notion that they need to include everything that we value in the world just really misses the point. Not everything has to relate to Burning Man.
When are you going out to the burn this year?
A couple of days, actually. I'm going earlier than I usually do.
Nice.
Yeah.
Well, we will have this podcast out in a couple of days, so you will get to have it on your sojourn home.
Oh my God, I can listen to this podcast on my way to Burning Man.
You can listen to your own self. That's the prank.
Is that?
The prank, this whole thing, that's the prank, is that you now are doomed to listen to your own. It's kind of like the end of the Seinfeld series,
yeah,
where it's just
that's
endlessly self-referential.
You got me. You got
right?
me.
I would be remiss not to give you some kind of a prank. Well, thank you so much for coming to my house and for writing this awesome book. The book is called The Scene That Became Cities, and I've been to Burning Man for 10 years, and I really learned a lot and got a lot out of this book. So if you're hearing this podcast before you go to Burning Man and want to read the book, I'd recommend it. If you want to read the book at Burning Man, I think we both would not necessarily recommend that.
You know,
go out and burn
and
read later. But yeah, thank you for all the articles you've written and your contribution to this blossoming community.
Oh, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure to be here. Thanks for welcoming me into your home.
Thank you for joining us for Life is a Festival. If you like the show, you can support it by sharing it with your friends, following it on Spotify, or reviewing it on iTunes. If you'd like to get more involved, you can join our Facebook group, Life is a Festival, where we talk about the show and you can suggest new guests. If you really liked the show and maybe want a little bit more, visit my digital tip jar at patreon.com/lifeisafestival.com. Whatever you do, I hope today's podcast helped you make your life just a little bit more like a festival, and I'll see you on the dance floor.